Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to our annual Halloween story share. Just in time for the Samhain holiday, I have gathered together some stories and poems and other tales from around the world, and I'm so excited to present them to you. So grab your favorite drink, grab your favorite blanket, grab your favorite person, and enjoy this little collection of magic.
The lock keeper's door. "This year we'll find it," Izzy said, their voice low but full of excitement. "You say that every year," Heather sighed as she locked the door behind us. "We can go look for a while, but we have to be home before my folks get back from Mike and Joe's party, or they'll kill us, okay?" She gave Izzy a serious look, then glanced at me, already knowing I'd be on her side for this. I smiled, glad it was dark enough to hide the blush creeping up my cheeks. Damn, she had that effect on me. Yeah, sure thing, I said, stuffing my hands in my pockets. "Although I still don't get the point of all this. You guys go out every year looking for some local legend, but haven't ever actually found something?" Izzy bounded over to the sidewalk and took the lead, turning around and walking backwards so they could give their tour guide speech. They loved to give speeches. With both their parents being members of the local historical society, they knew the entire history of the area, down to which tree was planted the day Lincoln's body passed through town on the way to his funeral. I gave a small sigh as Heather and I fell into step. "Almost 200 years ago," Izzy began, "there was a canal running through town, although it's just a little creek now. And this part of the canal was remote and heavily wooded. Although there wasn't a town yet, they needed someone to live here full-time who could operate the locks as boats came through on their way to the city. So the men in charge built a small cabin just off the canal for the lock keeper and his wife, putting them out here alone. Their names were Elias and Mara Kerwin. He came from out east, the youngest son of a farmer in the Catskills. Strangely, her history was unknown, like she didn't exist until she signed the marriage license. For a while, everything was fine. The couple made the small house their own, learning to enjoy the solitude. And after a few years, a railroad line came through, skirting past the edge of the woods. With the increased traffic, a town began to build up here, just beyond the forest, and the locals were a little suspicious of the lock keeper and his wife. The couple seldom left their home on the canal, but at night the town could see smoke from their hearth fire rising out of the woods. And when the wind was right, they thought they could hear singing. One summer night, the local blacksmith, Silas Kane, came home to his wife trembling like he'd been caught out in a snowstorm. As he was walking home, he said, he saw Mara Kerwin at the edge of the woods, clasping a brace of rabbits in one hand, her kitchen knife in the other. When their eyes met, the warm summer heat seemed to drop away, and Silas said he felt frozen to the ground, unable to move until she had disappeared out of sight behind the trees. After his story came out, there were whispers that the lock keeper's wife was a witch. Several more men claimed to see her wandering the woods late at night, carrying a curiously large woven basket. One of the biggest concerns to the town, however, was just how much meat the couple seemed to go through. Every time a livestock boat passed the lock, a boatman would give the couple one of his cargo animals in trade. But after that first day, the animals were never seen again. Izzy paused with a grin. All of this made the townsfolk restless. "This whole legend is just some weird remnant of the Salem witch trial crap from out east," Heather said dismissively, giving me her knowing look. "The lock keeper's wife was a little weird and didn't fit in with the town, so they decided she was a witch. Very original. By that logic, we would all be witches." "Who says we aren't?" I asked, giving Heather a wink. She smiled and bumped her shoulder against mine. "But that's not the end of the story," Izzy said, drawing our attention back as their feet dragged blindly through the fallen leaves behind them. I had to admit it was impressive how well they could walk backwards without tripping. I would have been ass first on the concrete by now if I tried that. Izzy cleared their throat and continued. On the edge of town closest to the forest was a farmer named Abner, his wife Elvina, and their three children. Elvina was known to be a kind woman, and every week when she made bread for her family, she would bake an extra loaf for the lockkeeper's wife. In this small way, the women became friends. One fall, Abner got his leg caught in the threshing machine on their farm. He died quickly from wet gangrene that had set into the wound. A few days after the funeral, Mara showed up at their door with some apples for condolence. She tried to comfort Elvina, but the woman had taken to bed with the weight of her grief, while her sister-in-law watched over the children. It was only 3 days until Halloween. Mara went to Elvina's bedside and told her, "Come to my house at the dark of night in 3 days, and you will find comfort. Tell no one." The idea seemed silly at first, and Elvina didn't really want to walk into the woods alone, but her friend's words circled around and around her head until she could think of nothing else. So on Halloween, Elvina waited until it was full dark and her children slept. Then she dressed and quietly slipped out of the house and into the night. She followed the worn trail through the forest to the lockkeeper's house. The door swung open before she could knock, and Mara met her on the threshold, lantern in hand. "This way," she said. The two women walked down to the canal, and near the stone bracing, someone had dug what looked like a root cellar into the rise of a hill, closing it off with a heavy wooden door. "Go to the door and whisper your husband's name," Mara instructed. "And no matter what you hear, do not open the door." Elvina worried she was making a fool of herself, but her friend looked so earnest, and the grief in her heart was so great that she needed some relief. She carefully approached the cellar door, resting her hand against the rough surface. "Abner," she called softly. The typical sounds of night faded away as she heard shuffling from inside. "Abner." She leaned her face closer as a faint voice croaked at her from behind the wood. "I'm here." The voice may have been weak, but it was unmistakably the voice of her husband. She began to weep as his voice came again. "Elvina, you did not come alone." At that, she heard the snapping of twigs as a figure stepped forward and separated itself from where it had been hiding in the shadows of the house. Like a shock of ice to the heart, she recognized the terrified face of her oldest son, before he bolted for the path back to town. The next day, the entire town had heard the story of a dead man's voice rising from that cellar. Mothers kept their children indoors, and the town men gathered to determine what should be done. In the end, there was an accident at the lockkeeper's house. No one in the town would admit to knowing how it happened, but both husband and wife were inside when the house went up in flames. The lock was abandoned after that, with the men in charge deciding to build another lock further downstream instead. After many years, most of the passing boatmen no longer knew about the history of the charred house in the woods. But the older men would warn them never to get off the boat there, and never to pass through the area after dark. Izzy let their voice die out, the cool October night settling around us. "That's a great story and all, but why do we need to look for this house?" I asked. Heather reached out, finding my hand in the dark, intertwining her cold fingers with mine. "Well," Heather offered, "one Halloween, when I was a kid, my aunt got drunk while babysitting and told me the story of the lockkeeper's house. She said the cellar door is still out there, and if you visit on Halloween night and say the name of someone who has died, they'll still whisper to you through the door." "Isn't it worth the walk if you could prove the legend was real?" Izzy cut in. "It's not too much further now." We had reached the edge of the forest preserve, and the faint moonlight we'd been using to see disappeared under the canopy of skeletal branches as they reached towards the sky with dark, hungry fingers. My heart beat a little faster. We had all come hiking here in the daytime before, sticking to the marked trails, but now looking ahead into the darkening woods, all I could hear in the back of my mind was Keith Morrison from Dateline saying something like, "Little did they know they were walking to their deaths." Chalk it up to an overactive imagination and too many true crime podcasts. Izzy was the first one to walk into the woods. carefully searching the ground for the faintest hint of a trail. I looked over at Heather as I reached back to the side pocket of my bag for the flashlight, waiting for her to say this whole outing was some weird kind of practical joke. She flicked her light on, and our pale orange beams skittered against the tree trunks, casting more shadows than they were dispelling. Izzy was already a yard or two ahead of us. "Don't worry," Heather leaned in and whispered. "Izzy has wanted to come out and look for the weird root cellar every year since we were 14. We never find anything. We walk for maybe 20 minutes before they get bored or cold. Then we go back to the house for spooky movies and bad candy." Her long hair brushed my cheek as she pulled back, the blonde strands looking almost white in the darkness. "All right, I guess a bit more walking isn't so bad. At least it's a nice night." I leaned my body in against hers just for a moment, our lips barely grazing before I turned and headed after Izzy. "Come on, then." We wove through the dense trees, eventually dropping our hands away so we could ward off the small branches that kept catching at our hair and clothes as we walked. The deeper we went, I began to get a creeping sensation that worked its way up my spine. It felt as if any minute something or someone might step out from behind the trees. I pulled my hands closer to my body, worried that if I reached them out, I might feel something beneath my fingertips other than bark. Heather kept pace on my left, her light swinging back and forth through the branches, while I kept mine trained on Izzy's back so we wouldn't be separated. After several minutes, I noticed fewer branches slapping against my thighs and the ground flattened out. Maybe we'd found a deer path? Slowly, the smell of a bonfire up ahead began to swirl up around us like a fog. Izzy paused and waited for Heather and I to catch up. "Do you think someone else is out here?" I whispered. "I hope not. It's a little weird running into someone in the woods like this at night, especially the preserve since technically it closes at sundown." Heather pointed her flashlight at the ground. "Maybe we should just head back now?" I offered. Izzy turned towards the smell of burning wood. "What if we're really quiet and we just go up ahead and take a peek to see who's here? Then we can absolutely head home," Izzy whispered, caught up in the thrill of possibility now. I looked at Heather, hoping she'd push back on this insane plan. But she was already switching off her flashlight and walking ahead. "Okay, but we make this quick." There was no way I was walking out of here by myself, so I turned off my light and followed. We moved carefully, trying to muffle our steps and avoid any cracking branches. Up ahead, the soft glow of firelight illuminated the edge of a clearing. And the moonlight, no longer barred by branches, glittered off the water of a small stream. We were a few feet behind the tree line, our eyes adjusting to the light as we looked around for some clue as to who had started the fire. The clearing looked empty. Aside from the fire, there were no people we could see, no food or drinks indicating that somebody had been camping here. And before we could grab them, Izzy had stepped out into the clearing and headed over to warm themselves by the fire. We followed them over, but I kept scanning the area for any sign of movement. The heat of the fire washed over me, sending a shiver through my body that had gotten used to the chill night air. I leaned closer and let it envelop me for a moment, watching the smoke dance up towards the overcast sky. "Oh my God, look." Izzy's voice went flat. We turned to see where they were looking, and there it was, a hillside that had been cut into, set now with a metal door so streaked with rust that it seemed to be weeping. At the top right corner, the metal had been peeled back, exposing a small triangle of blackness that the firelight didn't penetrate. "Shit," Heather said with feeling. "I never thought we'd actually find anything out here." I let our hands drop as I leaned forward to get a better view. "Do you guys hear that?" Izzy said, their head cocked to the side, straining to listen. "It's like whispering." "I don't hear anything," I said quickly, ready to leave the clearing and head back. "Izzy, it's probably just your imagination," Heather chimed in. "Let's put this fire out so it doesn't burn the whole town down and just head home." She began kicking dirt over the logs, causing the flames to sputter. I joined in and we had the flames quickly smothered until only the last wisps of smoke remained. "Okay, I think we're good to go," I looked up at Heather, but she was staring off wide-eyed. I spun around, willing my eyes to adjust to the dark, and in the distance I could see Izzy standing at the cellar door. As their hand reached for the latch, a beam of moonlight illuminated the clearing, and surrounding the cellar door was a patch of scattered bones. I opened my mouth to call after them, but the words died on my lips at the sound of rusted hinges swinging open.
Laying across a bed of wildflowers, I watch the night sky, like I have every night since you left. High above, the stars glimmered amidst a hazy mixture of purples, pinks, and blues. The stars reminded me of you, of me, of us, a goddess and her wild child. I closed my eyes for a moment, and when I opened them again, the sky burned orange with daylight. And somehow you were calling me.
Arlo! Arlo!
But your shout sounded distant and warped. I hurriedly got up and ran across the meadow to our simple home, a cottage engulfed by nature. I saw you, your figure, gliding out of the doorway, a concerned look pinching your features as you scanned the meadow for a glimpse of me, your unruly daughter. Your eyes finally found me, and you sighed with relief. Arlo, dear, I was so worried about you. You smiled as I ran to you. I reached out for an embrace.
I'm sorry, Mama.
But as I wrapped my arms around you, I could feel you were never there. At my touch, you bursted into a flurry of dandelion seeds. The wind blew gently, and with that nudge, each seed took flight, drifting further and further from me.
Mama!
I turned away as you vanished with the wind. Spotting our cottage door ajar, I decided to search the house. Where could you have gone? I wondered as I walked through our home. The shadows whispered in response, indecipherably and ominously.
Mama, where are you?
I entered your study. I watched the shadows spin and twist along the wall, dancing with the sunlight. Scanning the room, I saw something, someone, run past the window. I rushed over. It was you. In the yard, you were spinning playfully with a young child. The child giggled.
Again, Mama?
You laughed.
No, Arlo,
or we'll both be seasick. With a mischievous grin, you picked her up again and tossed her high into the sky. She floated back down to you, gently, like a feather caught in the wind. You smiled at her. Someday, my sweet, we will fly across these lands together. You grabbed her out of the air and tickled her. Maybe someday soon. You're almost flying already. The child shrieked with laughter. I turned away from the window. As I passed through the kitchen doorway, I lingered and smiled. A garden grew from the earth floor. A teenager was pulling at the weeds. I don't understand why we have to do this. Across the room, you glared at her. Arlo, in order to gain control of your abilities, you need to appreciate the earth for what it is in its natural form. The teenager grumbled under her breath. You could easily wipe out the weeds and grow the garden with the flick of your wrist. You smirked and took a sip of tea. I could. Yes. The teenager glared and growled, and more weeds grew wildly from the garden floor. You just laughed and shook your head. And now look at the work you've made for yourself. Adjusting your perch on the stool, you sighed. It is difficult to grow and harvest crops. We may possess the ability to call upon nature for our whims, but I would rather you sow your own sweat into the earth and appreciate each grain of dirt, each microorganism for what it is. Then maybe you'll begin to understand the greater ecosystem of life that we protect. I smiled at the memory of your words and brushed my fingers across a small pendant hanging from my neck. With each room, I followed the shadows of our past until I found myself in the doorway of our cottage once more. You waited there for me, radiant as ever. I reached out tentatively, unsure if the illusion would break again, but you pulled me into a warm embrace. This time, your presence felt as real as the ground beneath me. You wiped the tears from my eyes. Arlo, my love, there are bigger, darker things happening in the world. Things that I do not fully understand. You kissed the top of my head goodbye. But, Mama, I whimpered. I held you tighter, and you returned the hug. As you placed the pendant around my neck, you reminded me, my love for you is eternal. You pulled away. But I must do my part to protect the children of Dagmar. I watched you leave. Over the hill and into the world below. I waited as night turned into day. Days turned into weeks. Weeks to months. And months to a year. Again on the hill, I sat with the cool reminder of the pendant at my neck, and I stared up at the night sky, waiting. Always waiting for your return.
A Love Letter to Hades, Part 2. I light the candle, invoking him. Remembering how he used to hold me. Music I save for moments of crisp air, burned tobacco and turned leaves. Dark wine on my lips that would fill me as I remembered. I don't remember how to reach him anymore. I've spent too long in the warmth, my skin's grown lush and full, flush from sunlight and moving air. From looking outward and tending to gardens before me. But in the stillness, in quiet twilight and rain, I miss him. And all above and all below, before and within, is starting to turn, and God, how I long to follow. Longing to sink into the sea, to call back the serpents that carried me here, to ask, to beg, if only for a season. I would drown my senses for a moment to touch, burn all the leaves to push us closer to winter. I'd save my only seeds and promise to return, holding deep in my soul this salvation, this knowing you long only for me. Church bells ring in the distance. I feel my heart sink deeper. Hoping it carries me with it, hoping to return and to fall with grace as the leaves before me, to a home, to a season, back to the one who adores me.
I hold my breath over bridges and whisper church songs for the same reason. It is said that ghosts cannot follow you over running water, so I meet my ghosts on bridges. Rivers carry us, and they know this, and whether that is up or down, it's left to the water.
In the heart of a valley, at the base of a mountain, there is a town, but it wasn't always. For years, it was a hole in the ground where people dug out coal and copper and whatever else they could find. Over time, people stopped going to and from the area and instead stayed put. They brought their families, they built stores and farms and had babies. Due to the curious geography of the area, the town is only reachable by a single winding road. and a bridge. That was good enough for most of the townspeople, but occasionally, someone would come to the town to preach or teach or sell their wares. Hearing the stories of other towns and other states, people would get curious and wander up the winding road and across the bridge to seek out the wider world. One of those travelers was a man named Earl, who came to the town hoping to sell cures for life's ailments. He wore a big cloak with lots of pockets filled with tiny tincture bottles and sacks of powders. If you had a worry, he had a bottle filled with something foul he guaranteed could cure it. There were cures for the common cold, grip, and consumption for sure, but there were other uses too. The bottle called Mirth could bring you joy for a time. Metal would have even the meekest man work up the nerve to court a beautiful girl. And if you didn't have any money, that was fine. Earl would let you trade with him. He'd trade your mother's heirloom earrings for a bit of ardor if your husband had a wandering eye. Though the townsfolk weren't rich and ran out of valuable items quickly, Earl didn't mind. He would simply ask for more curious trades. Your firstborn child's laughter or your ability to see the color blue. People that couldn't pay up saw a very different side of the traveling magician. When the widower, Bill Barnes' daughter, became terribly ill, he traded the deed to his home for a cure. But it was too late for even one of Earl's brews. The girl died, and Earl showed up at Bill's door ready to collect. He thought the deal should stand, but the townspeople didn't, and ran him out of their community. On his way back up the mountain, however, he swore he'd seek out the old gods that lived in the hills and gain the power to enact revenge on the town. For many years after, the town experienced a number of calamities. There would be torrential downpours lasting days, sometimes weeks, and since the water had nowhere to go, it rotted the walls of homes and washed away crops. The cows wouldn't produce milk, or if they did, it would be spoiled. Trees cut for firewood would be found overrun with termites or rot before they could ever be used. Rumors sprang up that it was Earl, that he was still up there in the mountains, making trades if you could find him. Occasionally, some desperate person would take the winding road out of town. Sometimes they came back, sometimes they didn't. Everyone assumed that anyone who disappeared had taken the bridge out to seek their fortune elsewhere, but some people whispered that they'd crossed Earl, and he'd made them pay with their life. This was the way things were for the town, until a girl in black, with a matching hat and a little black cat, flew in on a broomstick. Within weeks of her arrival, the calamities stopped happening. There was no more flooding. The cows produced milk. Crops flourished. The town became a vibrant community again. She took up residence in a borrowed room in the attic of a local dressmaker. She traded hours in the shop in exchange for rent, but she needn't have bothered. The townspeople came in a steady stream to seek her remedies. They would have paid handsomely, but she declined all payment, instead saying she was simply a witch in training and didn't feel right taking anyone's money, which endeared her to them all the more. For the last several days, there has been a sad look in her eyes. Apprentice witches are only allowed to stay in a place for a year until they must move on. It is the afternoon of the final day of her year in the town at the bottom of the valley, and she is in the dress shop. In the shop's large picture window is an old but lovingly cared for scrubbed wood display shelf holding intricately tied satin bows resting atop one-of-a-kind hats. Next to those are shoes in bright jewel tones imported from across the sea. On either side are forms showing off the shop owner's latest fashions, all ruffles and bustles and audacious color choices. Amidst the riot of color and frills is the girl, a teenager, clad in a black sheath dress with a simple ribbon serving as a belt. She wears black stockings tucked into black shoes, and her black hair hangs straight and loose down her shoulders. She sings to herself as she cleans the top of the wood display at the end of a long workday, and with each note, the shop comes alive. The clothes left behind the screen in the corner get up, fold themselves, and walk back to their places along the wall. The leftover pins from an alteration done for the mayor's wife unstick themselves from the empty dress form and tuck themselves away neatly in a drawer. The wide-brimmed black hat next to the cash register attempts to fly off to hang on the coat rack, but a fluffy black kitten is currently making his bed on it and refuses to move. The girl's eyes flit to the counter. She smiles, and the hat stops struggling while a cozy scarf comes to wrap up the kitten.
I've never gotten used to that.
The shop owner, Gilly Green, entered, carrying a wicker basket draped with a checkered flannel cloth. The woman looked around the storefront, her eyes landing on the last two scarves, folding and refolding themselves, seemingly in a bit of a fight over which got to be on top. She walked over, shook them both out, folded them, and chose the blue to sit on top. When she turned back, the green leapt over the blue. If a scarf could look smug, it did. The girl in black sighed gently and put down the scrub brush. The shelf was clean. It had been clean. But stopping the work today of all days had made her anxious. She looked out the large window over the smattering of low shop buildings and off into the high expanse of the mountain beyond. A space in her chest felt hollow.
Today's the day, huh?
Gilly asked cheerily, walking up behind her to peer out at the dense forest covering the mountainside and the single road leading out of town.
We're gonna miss you something fierce, Verity Vox.
It's been a year,
Verity said quietly.
Do you really have to go?
The girl seemed to gaze inward for a moment.
Apprentice witches are only allowed to stay in town for a year, and then we must move on to the next town that needs us.
I figured that might be your answer, so I made up some goodies to help you on your way,
Gilly said, lifting the basket and placing it on the display counter next to a pair of ruby-encrusted kitten heels.
Hope you'll come back to visit sometime.
Verity smiled sweetly.
I hope so, too.
I just don't know what we're going to do without you. Having a neighborhood witch has been such a blessing,
Gilly remarked. Then she paused for a moment, and her eyes seemed to focus on something unseen in the middle distance. When she resumed, her tone was softer, more somber.
I swear we thought we were cursed. And then the Terry girl went missing a couple years back. Things hadn't been right for a long time, but when Tacita went off and didn't come back. But since you got here.
She trailed off but turned to look at Verity, a hint of pleading in her eyes. It passed quickly, and a grin replaced it. Verity smiled back, but her eyes couldn't keep themselves from looking back up the mountain and into the mists beyond. The single winding road that allowed access to and from the outside world twisting off into the trees and rocks above. She hadn't had to traverse it when she arrived here, but she would need to do so now.
Come on, Verity,
the girl thought to herself.
Where's your sense of adventure? Another year and you'll be a full-fledged witch able to live anywhere you want. Thank you for being such a gracious hostess, ma'am,
Verity said, throwing her arms around Gilly's neck and hugging her tightly.
I don't know what I would have done without you this past year.
The two embraced for a while, memories flowing unsaid, but present in the tightness of the hug.
Can I at least see you off?
Gilly asked after a moment.
Of course,
replied Verity.
I'd be honored.
Do you know where you're going to go?
I heard from a raven that there's a town by the ocean that had a bad flu year,
Verity replied.
It would give me a chance to polish up on my healing magics before I go out on my own.
Town by the ocean, huh? Sure I can't tag along? I could use a tan.
A witch must walk their path alone,
Verity said automatically, her words an echo of her mother's and her mother's mother. Then, realizing it sounded harsh, she added with a laugh,
But if I could have any companion on my journey, I'd be happy for your company.
Verity was unable to think of a reason to delay her journey and stay longer in the dress shop with its cozy upper room, where she had spent her days honing her magic and caring for her new kitten.
Come on, Jack,
she called to the mound of black fur still curled up near the register.
We'd better get going before we lose the light.
The kitten woke, his two large eyes bright moons amidst the inky blackness of his body. He stretched lazily and silently poured himself onto the floor to join the women. Verity whistled, and her hat flew off the rack on the wall and landed atop her head. With one last look, she took in a deep breath and walked into the street. The two women made their way to the end of town, chatting and reminiscing. Every now and then, someone would poke their head out a window or call out from their porch to wish Verity a safe journey. It didn't take long until the stores turned to houses that began to separate themselves more and more until the town was behind them and the two women were at the base of the winding road. Gilly looked up at the path that lay before Verity and remarked,
"Sure would be easier if you could hop on that broom of yours and fly out of here."
A sound of agreement echoed in Verity's throat, but she said nothing. These days, her broom was mostly for sweeping.
"It'll do me good to stretch my legs. Besides, I have Jack for company."
The kitten purred and wrapped itself around the girl's ankles.
"Thank you again for everything,"
Verity said.
"I'll send word by Raven when I arrive to let you know I got there safe and sound."
A look came over Gilly's face that was equally concern and relief. They exchanged final farewells and parted ways. The shop owner watched for a while as the girl in black made her way up the winding mountain road, unable to see the tears falling quietly down Verity's face. She'd done this 3 times before, but this one hurt more than she expected. As Verity walked higher into the mountains, the forest grew up around her, and eventually she was in such a dense patch of woods she could no longer see the town below. As often happens in old forests, she began hearing whispers in the distance. They were mostly spirits of place, tree sprites and night haunts waking up to wander their territory. Some, though, were the ghosts of people from the town, those who'd died after a long life and those who'd wandered into the mountain hoping to strike a deal. Her gaze flitted to Jack, but he was still a happy, tiny kitten walking alongside her. She felt at ease and began singing softly to herself. Her father's voice echoed in her ears. "Hold your breath over bridges and sing church songs for the same reason." Verity's mother had magic, but her father hadn't been without his own tricks and know-how. She drew from both wells when needed. The whispers in the forest grew louder the deeper she walked. Her feet stopped for a moment as Verity drew a breath, closed her eyes, found the core of her power, and began singing.
"And though this world with devils filled should threaten to undo us, we will not fear, for the gods have willed the truth to triumph through us."
Her words calmed the whispering voices, and most of them seemed to fade away or travel off further into the mountainside. A glow surrounded the young traveler and her cat, who now seemed just a bit larger than he'd been a few moments before. Less a fluffy kitten and more the protector of a home, keeping it free from pests.
"The Prince of Darkness grim, we tremble not for him."
One voice now seemed to come from the woods around her, calling her name. A low, gravelly thing. She walked on, knowing never to respond when an unseen voice speaks your name.
"His rage we can endure, for lo, his doom is sure. One little word shall fell him."
"You sure about that, Miss Witch?"
the voice said, now behind her. Verity stopped walking. She wasn't scared. She was annoyed. With a deep sigh, she turned on her heels and confronted the voice.
"Hello, Earl,"
she said coolly. The creature before her stood on 2 mismatched legs, one of a man and the other of a goat. The legs reached up into a body that was as much a tree trunk as it was a torso. A tattered cloak with a number of threadbare pockets draped around it. Its arms were withered, bony things covered in hanging moss and seemed to crawl with insects. Around its head was a crown of sorts made of antlers and branches that appeared to grow out of the mossy roughage that might have been its hair. It was the face that sent the slightest shiver down Verity's back. It was a different face than it had worn last time. The flesh drooped over whatever passed for the creature's skull. Inside the rotting eye sockets, the creature's eye shone as 2 pinpoints of light. One red, one white.
"Miss Vox,"
the creature called Earl replied, the lips of the face it wore not moving.
"Why have you come traipsing through my forest a second time?"
"I'm on my way out,"
Verity replied, surely.
"It's time for me to move on."
The piercing eyes considered this for a moment, and the voice continued hungrily.
Really? You're leaving?
Yes.
Earl's bony hands grabbed gingerly at the pockets of the moldering cloak. After a moment, two fingers drew out a little red flannel pouch that had been fastened with a porcupine needle. Earl reached out and offered it to the girl. Jack hissed, arching his back and growing to the size of a Labrador. Earl laughed.
This might make the journey easier. Would you like it back?
Verity recognized it as the pouch containing her power of flight, which she had traded some months back in exchange for the town's safety. She imagined how easy it would be to take the pouch back and mount her broom and fly away to the town by the ocean. She could feel the wind curling her hair and smell the cool air that pushed the clouds around the sky. She also knew that if she took the pouch back, she would be condemning the town below to a return of floods and rot and poisoned food.
No thanks,
she said casually.
I traded it to you fair and square. You keep it. Fly on out of here if you want. I have no further use for it.
The creature's face looked disappointed, or as disappointed as the face could look from behind the flesh mask it wore. Its hand held the pouch out for another beat, then tucked it away.
You know I cannot leave these woods, witch,
Earl said, but then continued in an affected tone.
I am king here, after all.
Verity chuckled.
King,
she thought.
That's rich.
From what Verity had learned, Earl had sought a dark power in the mountains. He'd found it, but it had come at the cost of his freedom and his body, and a veritable forest filled with ghosts of his victims. Somewhere along the way, people took to calling the creature Earl had become king as a kind of dark joke due to the crown of horns. The term had gone to the creature's desiccated head. Thankfully, magic, especially the magic of tricksters, is bound by certain rules, and Verity knew them all well.
I had no idea, Earl,
Verity said, concealing a smile.
Of course you didn't,
the gravelly voice replied.
But a deal's a deal,
Verity said.
A deal's a deal,
Earl echoed, and was gone. Verity bent down to pet Jack, who had, by now, grown to the size of a calf. Her familiar was protective, but he'd stayed by her side since she hadn't been in danger. Looking up into the sky, she saw that they would be losing the light soon, and she wanted to make it out of King Earl's forest by nightfall. The spirits that wandered the hills posed no threat to the witch or her familiar, but she still felt uneasy about treading the ground where so many dead lay without rest. The pair returned to their journey, traveling up the mountain. Verity sang a different song, a favorite of Jack's, in hopes to soothe them both. As she sang, a light grew from within her and cast itself out into the distance in a protective bubble.
The 12 months and the day being gone, a voice spoke from the deep. Who is it sits all on my grave and will not let me sleep?
Jack was almost back to normal now, ambling along at the size of a house cat that not a dog in the county would have messed with. The bridge wasn't far now. Verity continued singing.
Tis I, thine own true love, who sits upon your grave. For I crave one kiss from your sweet lips, and that is all I seek.
Suddenly, out of the dark, they heard a noise like a crack of lightning and the unsealing of a jar all at once. Verity stopped in her tracks to listen. The black cat at her feet was suddenly alert, his ears pointed forward, searching for danger. For a moment, there was absolute silence. Then, the softening twilight was broken by a loud, anguished scream. Fearing King Earl might have reneged on his promise, Jack became the size of a tiger, his hiss now a mighty roar. Verity held her hands up in front of her, quickly thinking of what type of spells she might know that could defend her. The witch and her familiar stood for a moment, the glow of Verity's spell still clinging to them, casting light into the shadows ahead. Ahead of them, on the path, there was a rustling of leaves and a breaking of branches, and a girl fell out of the air and into the path. Verity dropped her hands and rushed ahead. Jack was less convinced, retaining his size as he stood behind her watching.
"Are you all right?"
asked Verity, attempting to keep a measured tone. The girl lay in a pile on the dirt road. Her clothes looked clean but aged, as though they had stayed in the back of a closet for years, fighting a war with moths. She had russet hair that fell around her face as she gasped for air. She breathed heavily, but Verity began humming a tune that helped with healing, and the girl quieted down. After a time, she was able to sit up and brush the leaves and dirt from her face.
"Thank you,"
the girl said, her voice forced and dry as though it hadn't been used in a long time.
"I'm just glad we were here,"
Verity replied, searching the girl's features for injury and finding none.
"What's your name?"
"Tasita,"
the girl said, her voice finding its footing.
"Tasita Terry."
"The missing girl,"
Verity thought.
"I don't see any scrapes or bruises,"
Verity said.
"Are you okay? Can you stand?"
Tasita murmured as she gathered herself. It lasted only a moment, because her red head flew up as she gasped as if startled and looked around.
"Is he here? Can he see me?"
Verity looked around, peering into the trees, but saw nothing.
"Who?"
she asked, turning back to the other girl. Tasita's eyes were wide and wild, moving in every direction as if to catch a glimpse of an unseen predator. She whispered.
"The king."
"You mean Earl?"
Verity replied, unsure.
"Shh."
Tasita hissed, reaching to cover Verity's mouth.
"He might hear you."
"Earl can't hurt me,"
Verity said, her certainty causing the residual glow of her spell to brighten.
"I'm a witch."
"A witch?"
Tasita asked, panic turning to curiosity.
"Like a real witch?"
Her response came in the form of a low growl from Jack, who was by now the size of a pony, his massive paws pacing a circle at the end of the light from Verity's protection spell.
That's a familiar,"
Tasita said, her eyes wide with awe, the beginnings of a smile perking up the corners of her mouth.
"It is,"
Verity confirmed.
"This is Jack. Jack be nimble, formally. Say hello, Jack."
Jack's wide, glowing eyes fixed on Tasita as his body swirled and pooled and came up next to her in the form of an average house cat. She reached out a cautious hand, which he sniffed twice before deciding she was a friend and nuzzling her fiercely. She laughed. Jack purred. Verity smiled, but a look up into the trees showed her that they had lost the light. If she was going to take the girl back to the town, it would have to be in the morning. While she certainly didn't fear being in King Earl's forest, nor did she worry about the whispering spirits out amongst the trees, she wasn't necessarily interested in annoying him further. If nothing else, Tasita seemed quite shaken at the prospect of meeting him again, and that was enough to warrant avoiding him.
"We'd better set up camp,"
Verity said genially.
"It's too dark to take you back to town tonight."
"I can't go back,"
the other girl replied. She was smiling and playing with Jack, who was now back to the size of a fluffy kitten.
"Why not?"
"Don't want to,"
she said, but Tasita's drawn expression seemed to be masking a greater story. Verity had questions, but she could hear the whispering out in the woods growing louder as the night haunts woke to make their rounds. She sent Jack back off into the woods to fetch firewood and set to work making a campsite. She reached deep down into her black hat and pulled out two bedrolls. Then she divvied up the sandwiches and fruit from the basket Gilly had given her earlier that day. Tasita tried to make herself useful, but quickly found that the witch needed little assistance. She took to examining nearby bushes in an effort to look for berries. After a time, Jack came padding back into the area, dragging with him a fallen branch. Upon inspection, Verity realized it was oak, perfect for a protection fire. A few swipes of the familiar's paws, and the branch was transformed into tidy logs, which Verity arranged into a pile. The witch reached into her hat and pulled out some matches. Within moments, there was a cozy fire. Verity looked around, pleased with herself, and she found Tasita carrying overflowing fistfuls of berries.
"Dessert's on me,"
Tasita said, holding out her hands, a few berries falling.
looks tasty.
Verity replied.
If I wanted my tongue to swell up and choke me to death in my sleep. Ugh.
The other girl yelped, tossing the poisonous berries into the dark beyond the firelight. Verity laughed.
Sorry.
Tacita said, wiping her hands on her dress.
I guess I'm not much help.
You're plenty helpful.
Verity replied, tucking herself into her bedroll.
No, I've never been much good at stuff.
Tacita replied, and began munching on the portion of food Verity had laid out for her.
I'm sure that's not true.
No, it is. My family's always said so. My father has a successful carpentry business, and they'd expected my brother, Tommy, to take it over. But he up and left to go be a doctor in another state several years ago.
What does that have to do with you?
Well, they had pretty strict rules about a girl helping with carpentry. And my mama kept trying to teach me mending and laundry, but I kept ripping the stitches and ruining all the clothes.
You sound cursed.
Tacita's red hair spun as she looked directly at Verity.
You think so? I always thought so. Could you cast a spell and fix me?
Verity giggled again, finishing the last of her apple.
You're not cursed. I was joking,
she said.
Some people are just good at different things.
Tacita looked mildly deflated, then continued.
Anyways, they tried to marry me off, Matthew Miller, figuring that they'd eventually be able to retire on some of that dairy money, I suppose. But I told them I'd rather eat the cow's dung than marry the man milking them. Well, and soon after that, I made the decision to head out on my own. Maybe go see if I fit better in a city somewhere.
And is that what happened?
Verity asked.
You went off and came back?
Tacita trailed off.
What?
Verity asked, concerned.
I never made it. I was foolish and silly and everything my parents said I was. I thought I could maybe make a deal with the king for some money or a way out of here. Something sure, you know? But he tricked me. I never got further than these woods.
Tacita began to quietly weep, disappointment and resentment washing over her. Then a hand was on her face.
You're not silly,
the witch said, wiping the girl's tears and lifting her chin.
And you're not foolish. I also bartered with Earl.
You did?
The girl asked, sniffling.
I did,
Verity affirmed, looking at her useless broom leaning against a nearby tree.
I gave up my power of flight in exchange for the protection of the town.
Wow,
Tacita said, her eyes still watery.
That's big. You must be a pretty good person.
Verity shrugged off the compliment.
What did he take from you?
I told him, I don't want to be sad anymore. That I didn't want to need anything from anybody. He said he could do all that, but then he
took your heart.
Verity said somberly, noticing for the first time the little scar that poked above the neckline of the girl's dress.
He took my heart.
Tacita echoed.
Never be vague with a trickster, my mother always said.
Verity said with an awkward laugh, but then realized it sounded like she was blaming Tacita, which wasn't helpful or fair.
Sorry, he wouldn't have known.
The other girl looked unamused, but ignored the comment.
I kept trying to leave the forest, but I couldn't. I tried the bridge. I tried going home. I couldn't go anywhere. If anyone come up the road, I would try and get their attention, but they couldn't see me.
Verity cocked her head, remembering something she'd read once. She assessed the scar more closely and thought out loud, like a doctor diagnosing a curious medical condition.
Mortals can't live without their heart, yet here you are. I could see how you might have lived all tucked away with the spirits, but he must have you bound to him somehow.
The witch fell quiet as she puzzled over the issue. The crackling of the oak logs mixed with the swaying leaves overhead and the cool night air created a pleasant ambience. Even the distant whispering of the night haunts was its own kind of soothing music. Soon, the witch's puzzling became clouded. Her breathing slowed and her eyes grew heavy. She was nearly ready to fall asleep when Tacita's voice whispered,
"What about you?"
"Huh?"
Verity replied, rousing herself from her half-sleep.
"Where are you going?"
Tacita asked.
"Oh."
The witch picked herself up on her elbows. Her voice was filled with sleep, and her thoughts with salty air and a cozy cottage by the beach somewhere.
"There's a town far away from here, near the ocean. I thought I'd go there for my last year of apprentice training before I settle down somewhere permanently."
"A town by the ocean, huh? I wish I could come."
The thought of traveling with Tacita made Verity smile for reasons she couldn't quite name. There was something about her.
"A witch must walk their path alone,"
she could hear her mother say. A line from the coven's grimoire. But there was a second line.
"Until the witch's skills are honed."
Maybe this could work out. Tacita couldn't join her until she was free from King Earl. As she fell asleep, Verity thought she should do something about that. Early the next morning, Tacita woke and shuffled out of her bedroll. She yawned and stretched. She smacked her lips and looked around. No one was there. The fire had long since died out. There was no sign of the witch or her cat. A feeling of being very exposed and vulnerable crept over her. She called out, but there was no answer. She began worrying the fabric of the bedroll, nervously looking as far into the trees as she could see. Finally, she stood to leave, but as she did so, a crunching of twigs and rustling of leaves caused her to whirl around.
"Where are you going?"
Verity asked, entering the clearing a bit flushed and out of breath.
I thought you left,"
Tacita replied.
"I did,"
the witch said matter-of-factly.
"I got up at dawn and walked the rest of the way to the bridge."
"You left me here alone?"
the girl replied.
"King Earl could have..."
She didn't finish her sentence because just then Jack jumped down from a nearby tree where he'd apparently been keeping watch in Verity's absence. He was easily the size of a lion, or so Tacita guessed from pictures she'd seen in books. Verity smiled.
"I wouldn't leave you like that."
Reorienting herself, Tacita asked.
"So, why'd you come back?"
"Well, King Earl has something each of us needs, and I was figuring out a way to get them back."
"And did you?"
"I think so,"
Verity replied.
"But I'm going to need your help."
"My help?"
Tacita asked, nonplussed.
"How could I possibly help a witch like you?"
"If you're going to be my companion, you may as well start now,"
Verity replied with a cheeky smile. A few hours later, Tacita stood alone at the top of the ridge. From here, she could look down and see the outline of the town in which she'd grown up, where her family still lived. She felt a twinge of sadness, but more like the longing for a place she'd never actually known. Verity had told her that morning that it had been 2 years since she'd left, though it had felt somehow both longer and as though no time had passed at all. In either case, the town below wasn't home anymore. She looked out across the narrow bridge that led to the outside world. If she was very, very lucky, she would be crossing it soon. She took a deep breath and held up a flannel bag whose bottom was soaked in blood. Gathering her wits, she said in as steady a voice as she could muster the words she'd rehearsed.
"My father. Dost thou not hear the words that the Earl King now breathes in mine ear?"
A wind picked up, rustling the leaves. It smelled of rot, but Tacita continued.
"Be calm, dearest child, 'tis thy fancy deceives. 'Tis the sad wind that sighs through the withering leaves."
The wind blew harsh, suddenly knocking the girl over, but she held firm.
My father, dost thou not see?"
"You can cut that out now,"
the deep, gravelly voice of the Forest King interrupted Tacita. She whirled around to find the creature with its hanging face and mismatched legs standing in the way of the bridge. The glowing eyes behind the sagging skin looked her up and down, alight with anger. From deep within the bark and moss of what passed for a throat, a chuckle rang out, as though to shake out his annoyance at both being summoned and at being summoned by someone he thought he'd imprisoned. The creature spoke, but the fleshy lips didn't move.
How'd you wriggle yourself free of my grasp?
A traveling witch came by, and her magic knocked me loose,
she replied coolly.
Did it now?
The king said, the red eye rolling down to look at her bag while the white one held her gaze steadily.
And what's that you got there, little Miss Terry?
The witch's heart,
she said proudly. King Earl's white eye darted down to meet the one staring intently at the dripping sack.
There's no way you could have bested that witch.
I cut it out when she was sleeping. I came to find you to trade it for mine so I can finally go home.
The girl opened the bag and held it so that the great rotten creature could peer within. With a great sniff, the dark king of the forest could smell the witchcraft dripping out of the bag. It grunted hungrily. Drool poured out from behind the dead face as it reached a long, bony hand to touch it. Tacita snatched the heart away and closed the bag with a porcupine quill.
No way,
she said.
Not until you give me what's mine.
Without taking his eyes off the bag, it reached its bony fingers into the folds of its tattered cloak and pulled out a piece of flannel that had been bound up. It also was stained rust red, but the blood had long since dried. Without a pause, the old heart was tossed over to Tacita, who caught it with one hand.
All right,
Earl said.
You're free. Now, hand it over.
Happy to,
replied Tacita, who lobbed the bloody bag. The king stuck its decomposing nose into the bag and took a deep whiff. Its whole body shivered in anticipation.
Before you go,
the girl said,
I wondered if you might want this too.
King Earl looked up to see that she was holding out Verity's broom, its well-oiled handle shining in the late morning sun, light glinting off the curious symbols carved into the shaft.
Ain't got no use for that,
he said.
Can't fly.
Huh?
Tacita said, confused.
Odd.
Why's that?
Replied the king.
Well, I reckon you have the witch's flying magic, and now the witch's heart,
she said, tossing the broom up a few inches and catching it, watching how it descended slowly.
I assumed that might be enough power for you to get some use out of this. Maybe we could both get out of here.
Oh, yeah?
The king said.
And why would you want to help me out? I held you prisoner.
Tacita laughed.
Sure. But you gave me what I asked for, and in the end, I'll get to leave here. No harm, no foul. Chalk it up to a good life lesson learned.
Is that so?
Earl's white eye looked between the heart and the broom, while the piercing red eye stared into Tacita's, searching for the lie.
Of course. Why don't you try it for yourself? You've got the witch's flying magic with you, right? Pull it out. Give it a go.
Without waiting for a response, she lofted the broom over. The king grabbed it out of the air, the hope of leaving overcoming whatever niggling feelings of doubt it might have had. Earl set the bag with the heart down and riffled through its cloak until it pulled out the leather bag containing the witch's magic. Just as it was about to empty the contents, a great black shadow leapt out of nowhere and grabbed the bag from the king's hand. Shocked, the bony hand dropped the broom for a split second, but that was all it took. With a whistle, the broom shot into the trees right as a great wind picked up. Verity shot like a rocket out of the treetops, a cackle of delight escaping her lips. Enraged, the king reached down to grab the bag holding the witch's heart, but grasped only air. Looking up, the glowing eyes locked onto Tacita Terry, holding a heart in each hand. The king made to attack the girl, but coming up behind her was Jack B. Nimble. Tacita had been instructed earlier when Verity explained the plan not to look at him, as he would be in his true form, and mortals were not allowed to see lest they turn mad. King Earl had been given no such instruction and stared in terror at the great mass of endless black. The king dared not step forward and was now trapped between a boundary the king could not cross and a familiar it didn't wish to fight. Verity landed next to Tacita, who turned and gently held the heart over the fresh cut in the witch's chest. There was a soft glow and a rush of breath, and each heart was back where it should be, pumping away. Tacita's skin suddenly flushed pink, and she swooned from the rush of her body coming back to life. The girl and the witch stared into each other's eyes for a moment, a soft smile passing between them. And then the witch turned back to the king and began singing. As her voice lifted into the air, the breeze picked up again and swirled tightly around the creature. However, this time, other voices joined her.
The Prince of Darkness grim, we tremble not for him.
What is this?
The king spat.
You dare try and trick me?
Each word Verity sang was echoed by a face appearing from the forest, a ghostly victim of King Earl's coming back to aid and bringing him to justice.
His rage we can endure, for lo, his doom is sure.
I will destroy you. I will eat both of your hearts and feast on your bones.
By now a host of faces surrounded the gnarled creature, who was thrashing out at them as dozens of spectral hands grabbed a hoof here, a bony forearm there.
One little word shall fail him.
The witch reached out one hand to point at the king and grasped Tacita's with the other. In perfect unison, the two girls cried,
Absinthos!
The howl that escaped the rotten throat of King Earl ripped across the mountains. The trees around them shriveled and died. Birds dropped to the forest floor. The gathered spirits began dragging Earl across the bridge, a threshold the king was not allowed to cross. The creature thrashed and clawed, but the spectral victims would have their revenge. They pulled first the goat leg from Earl's body and threw it out into the air, where it caught fire and turned to ash immediately. The ghosts kept tearing at the king, even as the creature thrashed out in hot vines of power. But the spirits were bolstered by the witch's magic, and they could not be stopped. The girl and the witch watched as King Earl was pulled apart, bit by rotten bit, and dragged out into the air to become ash. The last thing to go was Earl's rotten skull. Without the flesh mask to cover it, the girls could see it was the desiccated face of a man whose nose had long rotted away and whose eyes were now sockets filled with black pools. It cursed and howled and bit as it was thrown by an elderly man who looked a little like Brady Barnes. As the head turned to ash, the ghosts vanished, released from their bond with the twisted magician. When it was all over, Tacita began giggling, a pure, ringing
yes.
sound. Verity joined soon after, and they fell onto the dirt, a tiny black kitten hopping between them until they settled down.
Well,
Tacita said, sitting up and dusting off her clothes.
Verity Vox.
Yes?
Answered the witch.
Where to now?
Verity stood up and peered off into the distant sky beyond the bridge.
There's this town by the ocean.
The ocean, you say?
Tacita said, leaning an elbow on Verity's shoulder.
You think there's a place for me there?
The witch looked over and met the girl's gaze. Smiling, she said,
There's a place for you with me if you want it.
With that, the two mounted the broomstick and flew off into the clear blue horizon as a fluffy black kitten settled down in the bristles for a nap. Well, rioters, that's going to do it here for this year's Hallowed Riot. My very special thanks to all those who contributed to make this year a truly magical one. Please remember that all the stories, poems, and tales shared here on this episode are owned by the respective authors themselves and should not be reproduced, copied, or otherwise shared without their permission. I hope that you and your family are safe and well. And as always at this time of year, I hope that your moons are always full, your hats are always pointy, and your Halloween is filled with magic. Happy Halloween, blessed Samhain, and I will leave you with love and light, firelight.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.